For me, one of the greatest privileges to watch on full display during the COVID-19 outbreak was that people who really didn't have to worry a great deal about this virus were obsessed with it. Mm. While those who had no choice were dying from it. I don't have any desire to stand on a soapbox and preach ever again. I find that is a divisive act in and of itself. I want to stand with my arms open and my ears tilted. I want to see and witness what's happening, and I want to try to understand and appreciate it. And then I can take action. As a person of privilege, I'm constantly finding a need to be humble in the face of this, to recognize how much I don't know about how other people's lives are. Not knowing means I lean in and I ask questions about them. Really? That's a question I've been asking all weekend. Really? Really?
Welcome to the Face Transition Podcast. If you've enjoyed the previous episode where I have a heartfelt discussion with Dr. Scott D. Miller, where we mostly discuss his book titled The Book of a Mormon, as well as his journey to becoming a psychotherapist, you'll enjoy this follow-up discussion where we go a bit more in depth into his practice as a psychotherapist, a trainer, and researcher. And we also discuss current event with the coronavirus pandemic, as well as the death of George Floyd, and where do we go from here? I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Again, thank you for joining the Face Transition Podcast.
What, maybe in the last few years, how has your practice evolved? I mean, maybe some new things that you have learned and gathered that helped you to reach this position where you wanted to do more coaching in your therapy, you know, combined therapy and the coaching. So I think it would be interesting to understand how you got there.
From the time that I was in graduate school, and I really went into psychology because of a professor that I met. I was an accounting major, and I met this professor, Hal Miller, who was a former doctoral student of B.F. Skinner. And Hal was at BYU, and attending his lectures was like a religious experience for me. Mm. He spoke openly about many things that were subjects that polite people didn't mention in public, that were controversial, especially at a conservative university like BYU.
So, Jess, can you give examples of some of the things that come to mind when you think of those?
Polygamy was one of the subjects that he talked about, and sociobiology was another, which was an emergent field. It's now called evolutionary psychology. But at the time, they were looking at the impact that genes have on behavior, and in particular, trying to increase the representation of your genes in subsequent generations. So if you looked at the leadership in the LDS Church, many of them still share a significant number of family members with one another. Yes. And Hal was talking about this from a science point of view, which was people tend to act, and at the time this was the language, to increase their inclusive fitness, meaning that you tended to act in a way to increase your genetic representation in the future. Mm-hmm. Now there's lots of challenges about that, but this was a controversial subject in science, let alone at a university like BYU, where the subject of polygamy, which tended to favor certain inside families with large numbers of partners and children, and then representation in leadership, that had a fairly profound message. And he was talking about it. And it was, I have to tell you, it was exciting. It was on the edge. Plus, he was just such a great lecturer, really.
Right. So, would you say that is somewhat of a common thing even in the world when you look at I'm thinking of the royal families. I'm thinking of even in Arabic or, you know, whatever clan or tribe or you know, wants to keep the wealth within a certain you know, among themselves. And so you see that happening. I wonder, and you would know that if it's a human trait to do that, to have that tendency to do that.
Well, evolutionary biology is evolutionary psychology rather, really is about how humans act to increase their genetic influence in the future. Mm-hmm. Richard Dawkins wrote a book right around that time called The Selfish Gene. And he basically said our bodies were simply ways to pass on our genes for the next generation. And we were crazy to have some narcissistic investment in who we were, since the body only cared about reproducing really in the future. So again, my point was, though, it was a very controversial subject, and meeting Hal is what made me want to enter the field, not because of the controversy, but the search for truth and understanding, really.
Right.
And his absolute devotion to science. And I studied experimental psych, which is the field that he had graduated in, for almost my entire undergraduate life. And then I ended up having a visit with him where he said, are you sure that experimental work is what you want to do? And he sent me to meet Mike Lambert, who was over at the Comprehensive Clinic at that time at BYU, and to talk with him about a potential career path in clinical psych. I think Hal thought that that's what I would be potentially good at. Michael was another person who was an amazing human being, an amazing teacher, and I have remained, I would call, friends and colleagues with him since those very early days, since I served as a research assistant looking up articles in the old days, not when we had the internet, but had to go to the library and pull journals. Uh-huh. Michael helped me get into graduate school. And I went to graduate school and I really wanted to learn how to do this therapy thing. I wanted to be of help to others, be willing to talk about whatever subjects people wanted to talk about. It turns out that the science led me elsewhere. The field has acted as though there are certain treatments for certain problems. And if you just get the right one, sort of like an antibiotic for a strep throat, then the people's problems would resolve. But the data didn't point in that direction. And so I ended up deciding at some point, together with a team of colleagues and researchers, that perhaps we would never figure out what the ingredients of successful psychotherapy were, but we could certainly measure it and see, were we helping or not? And when we began to measure, then we found out that certain therapists were more effective than others, and reliably so. Now, that was an interesting science question. How are they doing it? We stumbled upon the work of a Swedish psychologist by the name of Anders Ericsson, who spent his entire life studying expertise. Mostly what he was studying was why, when people spent their entire lives in a particular occupation, were they not great at it by the end, given how much time they'd spent on it. And what he found was that the people who really broke apart from the pack and who become great at what they did engaged in a practice called deliberate practice, deliberate, two words, deliberate, with conscious intent and practice over and over aimed at successful, successive refinement. And that's where I've spent the last 10 years, really, of my career, looking at how can psychotherapists, in this case, use deliberate practice to improve their craft, to achieve better results with clients, which goes all the way back to my earliest days as a therapist, feeling terribly insecure when I would sit across the room from somebody who was truly suffering and knowing what it was I was supposed to do and say to them. So more recently, my work is focused on that, helping clinicians identify the areas where their performance is weak and then developing exercises and coaching them to practice certain activities that will improve their effectiveness. So, and that's really pretty much where I'm at right now in my professional life and work.
It's remarkable and definitely needed. I always think I've seen, you know, a couple of therapists and I've lucked out because the two I've had have been very helpful, and they were, but I've heard stories, you know, of people going and it wasn't helpful. And I always wonder, how do you find that balance between wanting to connect with your patient and also keeping that distance? I mean, so that you don't let your emotion kind of take over or direct, you know, where you need to be. And as human beings, it's something that to me appears to be very difficult. Because you don't want to be fake in agreeing with, you know, someone and so tell me how that works. Like, you know,
I think that you what we know from study of top performing psychotherapists, at least, is that those who are more successful, those who have better outcomes helping their clients, are much less likely to experience burnout. And burnout, in part, or what's been called compassion fatigue, is listening to people's problems and concerns with no respite. I can't get away from it. And more troubling, I'm not helping. The reason most people enter the field of psychology or psychotherapy is because they feel at their core some interest in being helpful to others. So these two things are actually curiously connected. That if I'm helpful, I'm much less likely to be bothered by my client's story, so to speak. And after 35 years in the field, I can tell you, I still haven't heard it all. Still, people come in and I think, my goodness, the depth of the trauma, of the experience, or just that unique person's experience of events that I've, of course, heard about 1,000 times is profound. But the reward in that, and the thing that protects me from those very tragic stories, is the client's growth and their change. They're moving on to a better sense of well-being. So I think that's what protects me, which is, of course, connected then with my efforts to figure out, how can I get better? How can I expand the work I do to include a person who I might not normally connect with, or a problem I might understand less?
And like you say, not getting to that fatigue of, you know, emotional fatigue, or, you know, I've heard it, I'm tired of listening to the same story. And that, does that, would you say that it gives you a better sense of who humans are, like even in general, you know? Because at the end of the day, humans are humans. We may have our particular trials and concerns. Of course, some are a lot worse than other, but isn't there like a common thread that you are starting to see among everyone? And,
you know, I think that from a 20,000 foot level, and I can't remember who said this, but even stories that are written about in fiction, I think somebody once said they're like 7 plot lines. And after that, it's just variations on those themes.
That's so what I would think.
If you were at 20,000 foot, then, you know, it starts to get boring, I suppose. But there's a difference between Romeo and Juliet and Streetcar Named Desire, even though the plot lines are very similar. So there is the differences in the particulars, in the culture at the time that the stories are told.
Or you take Romeo and Juliet from Shakespeare, or Romeo and Juliet from Baz Luhrmann.
That's right. That's right.
Two similar quote unquote stories, completely different interpretation, but yeah.
So I do think
and you can go on and on with that. You know, you have that theme, and so I see what you mean.
Once you get down to the small parts, and this I think goes back to what we were talking about with regard to my mission experience, we were there to tell our story. Mm-hmm. But what I got intrigued about were the Swedish stories, mm-hmm. their culture, mm-hmm. their history, the people whose doors I were knocking on. And if I could just be quiet long enough to hear it, they were very willing to tell it. And so that's where I've spent my life, at the edge, listening to those particular stories. And people are really very interesting. If mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about, and this is a sort of delicious private pleasure that my wife and I have, we watch Dateline, and it's always the same story. One partner kills the other for the money. It's the same story. But what's interesting about these stories are, again, the particulars, the people involved, the their lives that they had led up to that that point. And then what happens to them afterwards, once they are going through the judicial system, all of those things make life interesting and worth listening to.
Yes, people are, we're all storybooks, right?
Yeah, we
are. On different kind of storybooks.
Yeah, and if you just scratch us a little bit, a big story comes out, really.
Right.
That defies these sort of stereotypes that people have. That's why I would say that if you were transitioning, as we talked about last time, out of the church, getting beyond the headlines about Gentiles or people that aren't members is enlightening and provides such alternative ways of viewing the world and life, most of which seem to work pretty well, or at least just as well as the one that I grew up with.
Yes, and it's just funny how... probably the more sheltered you've been, the scarier it is, because, I was very Mormon when I was Mormon, but I was also living in Europe among non-Mormon, 90%, 99% of them, So I was used to, I knew how to live without being in the bubble, but people who are not used to that, because America has those bubble everywhere of neighborhoods and around the world where you can truly just be with these type of people and not really interact with anyone else. So it's interesting to see.
And the internet has, I think, made that even worse, because you can live inside the bubble of your newsfeed. You can choose who you speak to, etc. You can rule out everybody else. And I'm not criticizing that. If you're happy inside the bubble, why not? For me, there wasn't enough oxygen in there.
Goodness. Yes, that's so, exactly what I used. Yeah. That's exactly what I used. I was starting to suffocate. And to me, life is about expanding. And once we stop expanding, we just go around and around. To me, it's like being a hamster in a cage, doing the same thing, seeing the same thing, the same people, the same food, whatever. Like that is, and my nature, my DNA is worldwide, my grandfather started in Portugal and went to Africa. My mother started in Africa, went to Belgium. I started in Belgium, went to the US. I mean, we are just nomads from I don't even know how far that goes, but that's who we are. I really wanted to ask you, how has this whole COVID-19 experience been with you and the people you're in contact with? And then we'll move towards that discussion you had to Stephen Jenkinson and a couple of the questions that you asked that I wanted to ask you. So how have you dealt with it and with your practice and everything else, whatever you're willing to share?
I spend my life on the road typically. So I'm gone at least 2 days a week. And most months, except for July and August, I'm gone 10 days or more in a month. And in the United States and in Europe, especially, traveling and teaching. So when the borders were shut, my entire life and livelihood came to a screeching halt. That happened in mid-March, and I've been home now since. And I don't believe that the system or other governments are going to open up anytime soon. We are now at June 1st. And I think my travel could be restricted for the rest of this year. And then depending on what happens into the months of 2021. So there's been a, it's been a tremendous impact in terms of my livelihood. It has been. At the same time, I have great colleagues. So we've been working to put our work online as much as possible. I've been continuing to do consultation and coaching online and spending the time that I have left updating my websites and such. So I live a fairly privileged life at this point. It's not as though we're not going to have food. There are a lot of people in Chicago that don't have food, that are on the edge of being evicted or losing their homes. So again, I feel fairly lucky and privileged in terms. At the same time, I love doing training. I love being out and connecting with people. So I'm hoping that that's going to happen soon. How else did I deal with this? I did what I do when I have questions. It's a thing that I've done since I was eight, and asked the teacher, where in the whale could a person live for 3 days? So when all of the news came out back in actually late January, I was changing my news feed so that all of my research feed was COVID related. What were we learning? What did we know? I was reading studies as best as I could understand them, and then putting out thoughts and predictions on my various social media feeds to get feedback about what other people were thinking and experiencing. But that's just the way I have approached life since I was little. So when the media was saying the death rate from COVID-19 was 3.5 to 10%, I thought, what? That can't possibly be the right rate. And it turns out it wasn't. And they were off by a huge,
a lot.
By just huge, massive, how much they were off. And
It's sad. I didn't buy that either because I kind of looked at the other flu, and again, we don't know what we don't know, but we can look at history and what happened in the past, and I was very skeptical. In fact, depending on areas too, right? I mean, because it was of course more dramatic in some areas than not, but I think it's just sad how when you give wrong information, you know, I mean, look at what happened, like no more toilet paper, no, I mean, and was that necessary, you know, in the end, when you look at what happened, it wasn't.
What it certainly was is predictable. And I think it does show that something that I grew up with, we need to be prepared. So I was an Eagle Scout, and that was part of the scout motto, right? To be prepared. The church at the time had all of this stuff about food storage, which at my house meant buying things like giant cans of wheat that we didn't even have a grinder to grind into bread. You know, it was like absolutely crazy, and water that we didn't rotate, you know. So,
and then you end up throwing stuff away because it gets bad.
Absolutely crazy. But the idea of having enough to survive 2 to 3 weeks.
Yes.
I mean, or I think, a month, I think is really critical. Yes. I also think self-reliance, that you could take care of your family or your extended family, and maybe even have enough left over for charitable acts during times of crisis. I think is would also be critical. And the next one is not to pay too close attention to the legacy media and social media.
Yes.
Especially in the middle, we're looking for clarity. We are a species that really doesn't like not knowing.
And so we are
constantly buffeted by the changing message in the media. And then whatever agenda, if they have one, that they might have, which I think is mostly to have us watching.
Right. Yes. And The good thing is, though, living in the time we live in, is that we can also do our own research and look at the people who actually know what they're talking about, you know, and go with that as much as possible. I mean, for me, again, I look all over the world. I don't just rely on US media. Like, you know, I look at what's going on in Europe. I look at what's going on in the Middle East, where my sister is. I look at what's going on in Africa, where some of my family live, and I see what the people on the ground are experiencing. That's to me was the most telling. And again, it will depend from area to area, but they know what they're living. It doesn't matter what the media say, they know what's happening. They know who's going to the hospital. And so it was good to be connected. I mean, I was seriously talking to, still now, like I talk to at least three different continents every day, taking news from, you know, family or friends or whatnot. But yeah, it's just sad to me, the amount of stress, you know, and trauma, again, you know, trauma at some level, and some huge level. I mean, people who, you know, lost their businesses or there is a collective trauma. I've also lost, you know, a family member to COVID. It's just a lot. And I think it's been, and you touched on that last time we spoke, this collective awareness that's growing of how interconnected we are, how we depend on each other, how we need to do better. What are some of the things you've noticed? We talked about you and your situation, and you seem to have fared, you know, pretty well considering that you're not, you know, one of the destitutes out there. But on a more psychological and spiritual level, like, what have you noticed?
I think right now, in terms of phases, we're still in the honeymoon phase
of what?
Natural disasters. So initially there's the shock, and they've actually done some research about this, looking at, so there's phases of a disaster. I think phase four, they call the honeymoon phase. And that follows the heroic phase. So we were in this phase, and you can almost hear it, where we're lauding the people who are coming in to help us and save us. And it's true. It's not denigrating or making fun of it. It's just after the impact of this disaster, whatever it may be, it could be Katrina, or it could be the outbreak of the coronavirus. First, you're kind of shocked into inaction. We stand in place. Eventually, we're talking about the heroes and people doing great things. Then there's a honeymoon phase where it seems like everything is going to work out and everything will be fine. That people are working together in a nice way. But the next phase, I think, is the more challenging phase. And it doesn't take anything away from what I said last time about living in perhaps the best time ever in world history. And I think comparatively speaking, from 20,000 foot, we are. That doesn't mean that on the ground there aren't gross inequities and problems.
Oh, no, no. We would, none of us would want to be in the Middle Ages or,
I think.
And antiquity, right. Or we do live in a good time.
and even 1960, as much as we look back, some of us now at our age, and say, oh, what a great time the 60s were, revolution, love. Yeah, you know, there was a lot.
Depends on who you are and where you live.
That's again. Exactly right. Exactly right. So what comes next? Phase five is kind of the disillusionment phase. And I think we should probably be prepared for that. The road ahead to recovery is going to be long, and it's going to be difficult. And we're going to need to work together like we've never worked together before. And for a nation that is as riven as ours is presently, between red and blue and people of different backgrounds and cultures, now's the time to really move together to face that disillusionment. Not everything's going to work out. There was going to be, I think, a fairly significant amount of pain and suffering. There already is a lot of pain and suffering. We've seen it in the paroxysms of despair in response to Mr. Floyd's murder, and the cry for social and racial justice in the country. So I think we've got some hard times ahead. fighting that disillusionment as we now have to work at very concrete problems, trying to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm. They are very concrete. I do, you know, this morning I woke up a little more hopeful than I had the previous days where I have not slept well for, you know, this whole week and, you know, getting messages, you know, right and left. And by, of course, you know, the media blows things up. Not that, you know, I don't want to minimize what's happening, but the media, I mean, my sister's like, when are you moving out of there? What are you doing? You know, it sounds like there is a civil war in my backyard, but I also live in the suburb where, you know, if it weren't for the news, I wouldn't know anything of what's happening. I mean, yes, there was something happening in downtown Dallas, but that's 40 minutes drive away from where I live, right? So there's nothing happening in my neighborhood. There's nothing happening, you know, right here. But I am aware because I am not one of those who, you know, just bury in a hole and don't want to see, don't want to hear. Like, I feel with people who heard, my kids pay attention, they ask questions. And so I was upset. It's a very outrageous and upsetting event that just happened, you know. And the people who aren't, they have a problem. People who are not affected or outraged at what happened have a problem. That said, I have also learned, and sometimes you don't know how long it takes, and depending on, you know, the level of your trauma, I don't know how long people have to stay in that angry phase. But I've also learned that staying there doesn't help in the long run. I mean, you need it as maybe a catalyst or something, or you need a process. We all know that, you know, emotions are important, whatever they are. But also, I don't want to be the angry mom or the, you know, I want to look for the good. And so that's the post, I don't know if you saw on my Facebook page that I posted this morning, but I said, I have hope. I have hope for my children. I have hope for this country, because out of this will come something greater. And you have to hope for that. It may not happen tomorrow. We know it takes time. Change takes time. But wouldn't it be great if we are part right now of this huge turn in history? You know, a friend of mine said, yesterday, she called me from New Jersey, and she's a white woman, and she said, you know, it feels to me that, you know, the civil rights movements and all the commotion that happened was round one, and it was incomplete, and now we have round two, and we need to finish this. And I thought it was beautiful, because that is very hopeful. It's like, yes, there is commotion, yes, there is anger, but also the media doesn't focus on all the police who have been kneeling, who have been helping, who have been marching. You know, they're showing a little, but I think there is a lot more good that's happening than bad, actually, right now, with people rallying together, uniting, seeing. And to me, that's very, very hopeful.
Yeah, you know, and this is far outside my role, either as a psychologist or somebody who's was raised LDS. I feel inclined to lean in and try to understand and try to listen. There are so many suffering people. There are so many problems. And oftentimes despite my efforts, I'm not informed about things. So much of this last weekend, I've spent listening to conversations in social media, listening to news stories, listening to family and friends around me, just trying to understand more of what's going on. And in doing that, I end up able to clarify my own feelings. I don't have any desire to stand on a soapbox and preach ever again. I find that is a divisive act in and of itself. I want to stand with my arms open and my ears tilted. I want to see and witness what's happening, and I want to try to understand and appreciate it. And then I can take action. As a person of privilege, I'm constantly finding a need to be humble in the face of this, to recognize how much I don't know about how other people's lives are. Not knowing means I lean in and I ask questions about them. Really? That's a question I've been asking all weekend. Really? And I think through that, maybe we'll become closer.
And I agree.
I'm trying to avoid the divisive, those that are just merely there to divide.
Yeah, and it's shocking to me. The good has been I shouldn't say shocking, because that's not the word for when good things happen. I mean, it's been uplifting to see all of my friends, all of my white friends, you know, being reaching out and saying, hey, you know, I'm sorry, you know. And, you know, some people going to marches, which I haven't done. It feels good to see people reacting and not just say, you know, moving back saying, hey, I'm not racist, I have black friends, you know, I'm okay, like, and moving on, you know. It's been good to see that. It's also been eye-opening because I don't really pay attention. I don't usually pay attention a lot because I didn't grow up like thinking color. Like, I didn't. It just wasn't a thing where I grew up. And so, but to see people say things like, hey, we're all fighting, you know, black, whites, we're all, you know, suffering and, you know, kind of generalizing. That has been painful to me.
to read stuff
like that.
And, you know,
that white fragility. And I'm like, oh, that's what it is. Okay. Now I get it.
Yeah.
But to see it in action was quite, yeah. I'm like, okay, now I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I'd like to give people the benefit of the doubt that most people don't know about, and secondly, they don't even know how to react in these situations. And but that said, I think in the position I'm in terms of my work, I'm often having to ask and try. I'm often having to listen to people whose views, personally, I find abhorrent or so different from my own life and values. But I feel like that's the bridge.
Yeah, you can't
get to know.
That's where it would be so hard.
Yeah.
to just not let you yourself get involved, because that's not what they're there for. But if you can help them see themselves, see how they can change, which is a very kind of roundabout way of, which is, I guess, not also your role to do that, but some part of you would want to do that.
Well, another thing I've been asking myself this weekend is, as opposed to saying, well, that's this kind of person and that's that kind of issue, I've been asking myself, how do I contribute to this mindlessly or consciously? What role am I playing in this? So we can say you are racist or you're not racist. I think this is a bit of a distraction from asking what role am I playing in the continuation of what people are suffering from?
Yes, that is the question.
And if I do that, I can find all sorts of strange parts of myself that I'm not proud of in this. And that's okay. I can find them, I can talk about them, and I can then take action from there.
Yeah. It reminded me of, I don't know if you're familiar with Derren Brown.
Sure.
Have you seen like The Push and Sacrifice and all that? Like, when these are very eye-opening, you know. What you said about leaning in and listening, that is how we learn. People fear what they don't know. They fear what they don't understand. They fear That's what they're not familiar true. With. And so get to know people. They're good and bad people in every shape, form, color, race, nations. You know, we are just humans at the end of the day. but focusing on or categorizing, which people also tend to do, which is sad because that's what creates, you know, the biggest conflicts. Back to COVID, I wanted to see what your thoughts were about what Stephen Parkinson said about the state of the elderly people. It has been heartbreaking to see how this disease kind of has chosen, you know, certain people, right? It's like, it's almost targeted. Mm-hmm. Of course, the vulnerable, but mostly the elderly. And he talks about, in that discussion you had with him, he talks about how we as a society have also chosen to park the elderly, to, you know, set them aside. And that made me think, because I remember growing up, I mean, I haven't known any of my grandparents, and I have this fond feeling for people who are older, maybe because I haven't known any of my grandparents on both mm-hmm. sides. They all mm-hmm. died before, you know, I could know them, or they were in different places. But my mother would tell me how, you know, in the culture she grew up in Africa, you take people in, you know, you don't let your elderly people go somewhere and die somewhere else. And you know, in Asia, it's the same thing. You take care of your elderly people, and many cultures have that. And I think Western people had that too, but lost it, you know, along the way. And still some people do, but it's not generalized, and it's difficult. Not everyone can, or, you know, I'm not trying to judge here. My mother was living in Portugal, and I was here when she passed away. So, and she also said she would never live with her kids. So it was a personal choice. But what are your thoughts about that, if any?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert in any of this, really. I started rereading Stephen Jenkinson's work. He wrote a book, he's written several books, but the one that is, I think, most pertinent right now is a book called Die Wise, which is about the North American and largely Western European medicalized society's views of death, and that we tend to avoid it. Now, Stephen Jenkins would say that, oh, we all say, oh, yes, we know we're going to die. But Stephen would say, and he does in the interview I did with him, that we certainly don't act like that's the case. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas perhaps generations ago, death was present. It was there. Mm-hmm. It's why we call the front room in our house the living room. Mm. We reframed the name of that room, which was called the parlor, because so many died from influenza at one time. Mm. They couldn't put them all in funeral homes. So they would have the viewing inside your house, in the parlor, in that front room. So many negative traumatic feelings were associated with that. We now euphemistically call that front room, or at least I did when I was growing up, the living room. I think that's kind of interesting because we were never in that room. We weren't allowed in it as kids. They had the nice furniture.
I never knew that. I never thought of that, where that came from.
So, and I think it's actually related to what we were just talking about. Certain groups of people we put away, and as long as they don't infiltrate our space, then the world is at peace. And the elderly, again, according to Stephen Jenkinson, because this isn't my point, we have put away from us because of our discomfort with the dying. And instead focused on what he calls our constant flight. We're always in motion in modern culture. I find it interesting, for example, that some people who've been doing some research in this area, Jeb Brown and Robbie Wagner, have found that during the COVID-19 era, when the breakout started, children's measurements of their mental health went up. In families. Now, I'm not talking about a decline in reporting of child abuse during this time, because that's a disaster. The teacher's eyes are not on these kids. Other people's eyes are not on these kids. And that resulted with them living with their abuser. But for kids already in care, the possibility of spending time with family.
Yes.
What kind of a big surprise is this? Suddenly their suffering went down. So
Interesting. Yeah.
We, in a way, have put away the elderly, again, according to Jenkinson, into places where we don't have to watch that struggle, where we don't have to be reminded. And Stephen Jenkinson, mm-hmm. I think, would also say that in the modern era, we don't talk about dying. We don't do the process together. Instead, we talk about courageous battles. We don't talk about or experience dying. That's something right. people do in hospitals. And believe me, mm-hmm. I did another interview mm-hmm. with an ICU physician who's been in Chicago dealing with the COVID outbreak from the outset. Mm-hmm. He says, you don't want to die in a hospital.
Mm, no, but that is horrible.
But that's where that's where we send people. People die in hospitals, our elderly go into these places. Now, that's not saying anything, just as you said, about people's rights. If they want to be in a retirement community, mm-hmm. have activities, that's not what this is about. Mm-hmm. This is mm-hmm. about us putting folks that right. our society has a hard time with, mm-hmm. folks that mm-hmm. are disabled, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we don't support their living with us in the home. And literally taking care of their death as they go along. And for me, one of the greatest privileges to watch on full display during the COVID-19 outbreak was that people who really didn't have to worry a great deal about this virus were obsessed with it. Mm. While those who had no choice were dying from it.
That's interesting. Yeah, that is very interesting. I've also heard someone say recently that it's amazing to see how much people worried about things more than they worried about people. Hmm. And my haircut and my this and my that and, you know, whatever stuff I need or fun restaurant games. That was more in the talks than the actual people suffering, dying, you know, dealing with it, you know.
And other people are in rowboats, you know, weathering tidal waves. So yeah. Let's not act like we're all in this together. Let's reach out yeah. a hand and say, what can we do? What can we yes. do? 40 million people are unemployed right now, 40 million. And my guess
That's
is
insane.
That all of them have at least a partner and probably a couple kids. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you start doing the math about this, we're talking about huge numbers. And I think finally it's reaching up into the into people who have been able to weather this better. So we'll see. And
right.
you know, I think these things are connected. So income inequality, then the shutdown, yes. very little voice in the process. You know, the whole last 2.5 years, which to me, you know, everybody talks about Trump, but Trump is just a symbol to me of this.
Oh, he's, yeah. He's, I mean, you can't put it all on one person. I was just having that conversation this morning. It's like, sure, he may have activated this or that, but you can't create all this mess, you know, by yourself or in one term even. It's a congregate. But in a way, you know, this, it's when things explode, it's sometimes good because it's this kind of this disease that's like dormant, right? And when you see it for what it is, and you're able to, you know, it's in the open. It's easier to do something about it than when people are still, you know, patching, putting band-aid over band-aid over band-aid when it's still pusing on underneath, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You get that better than anyone else because you do that with the psychics.
I think the real question becomes is, how would I live differently? So we've just had these protests and riots in various cities. What will we be doing differently if this were the case all the time? Mm-hmm. If we were aware of this undercurrent until recently. So the question for me is how would we be living differently? Mm-hmm. If we embraced awareness of that strong current, that feeling that is there in a significant proportion of our neighbors and other folks, what would we be doing differently? if we were aware of that now, and if it were, if there were protests and demonstrations every day, that might motivate us to make different choices as a people. And the same thing with regard to death. If we were truly aware of our death, now, as I said, Stephen Jenkins would say, oh, we all talk about this in a very glib way. Of course, I know I'm going to die. But we don't act like it, he would say.
Yes.
We act. And so, and the example he gives in my interview is oil. He says, we all know oil can't last forever. That's what he says. But we don't act like it. Whoa. That's an astonishing thing. So, oh, yes, we know there's racism, there's injustice, there's economic inequality. Oh, yes, we know that. I don't think anybody, if you said to somebody, oil's going to run out someday, I don't think you're going to get an argument from too many people. We live on a planet. We can't escape from here. There's the planet only contains what it contains, and once it's gone, it's gone. That's just the way it is. But this is a very unreal notion to most of us that it could run out. And Jenkinson's point again, I think, which really took my breath away, because if he asked me first, well, you think oil's going to stay forever? Well, no, but you know, but he says, well, we don't act like it is. We're driving around in our cars. We burn lights unnecessarily. We're not mindful. So what would we be doing differently, he asks, if we were truly aware of our impending death, if we were truly aware of those less privileged than us, what would we be doing differently in that particular case? How would that we be acting?
That is a very profound question, and definitely I'm also not doing enough. And you know, it pains me though, because I feel like as a society, you know, I tried, you know, I lived in Switzerland for 7 years. I never used a plastic bag, hardly, maybe not never, but you know, you pay, you forget your bag at the grocery store, you pay like a dollar or two for a bag. I mean, do you think that would dissuade people from forgetting to bring their baggy trap? It becomes a habit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I was, you know, you come and you have all these hopes and you want to see it happen and then it doesn't. I mean, and I try. I mean, I'm flawed because you get in those drones and you follow the system and, you know, and you want to make a difference, but then you're the lone person doing it. And so when the community, that society doesn't follow, people get discouraged, right? That's one thing. Yeah. And then there's also this mentality, well, we're all going to die anyways. You know, I want to enjoy as much as I can before I can't anymore. But that's super selfish, because what do you left behind to your kids and your grandkids and whatnot, right?
If you truly knew you were going to die tomorrow, I don't think most people would say, I'm going to Disneyland.
No, I agree.
I think most people would say, I better go say I'm sorry to the people I've offended. I better go hug my children and spend more time with them. Because at the end of the day, nobody who's on their deathbed says, God, I wish I would have gone to France.
Yeah.
You know, they don't say that. Maybe some do.
Yeah. You know, you gotta go to France once in your life. But
it was nothing against France, I promise you.
No, I'm not French. I'm the neighbor. But
I know.
I agree. And you know, I think for me personally, I was a bit prepared because the death of my mother was so close, right? February, I go to a funeral. I went to another funeral in November of a very dear friend. And then COVID happened. So I was already in this, you know how it is when you lose someone, you confront it with someone you love deeply and you confront it with death and it lingers with you. And by the time COVID hit, I still had that linger. I still had that hole. I still had a lot of death thought and talk around and within, which you don't see the world different. And I was happy to spend time with my kids. I was happy to be quarantined with my children. I didn't complain about that. Well, I lost my job. So I lost my job. So it helped, because I wish I didn't have to, because it's hard when you have to do both. But I just enjoyed that time with them, you know. That wasn't painful. It was, and also, and I think it's mostly losing my mother that triggered that extra love. Like, I don't know how long I'll be with you guys, you know, because at the same time, Kobe Bryant and his daughter and all these people on the plane, they died around the same time.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
And in some small way, I felt grateful that my mother wasn't, you know, she was 83 and not 40 something when she passed, you know, because think of these people. And that's where I'm coming back to what he was saying about accidental deaths, that I didn't quite, like, we treat death like it's an accident, but it's never an accident. At some point he says that, and of course I take that very literally. and Kobe Bryant came to mind, and I'm like, sure, he must have had a moment, because everyone who goes on a plane, I think, has a moment of like, oh gosh, I could just crash and die, you know, like sometimes some people have true fear of flying, and some people, for those who don't have a true fear of flying, it's a thought that always kind of comes through, but then goes by, right? So do you think what he was trying to say is, no matter how death happened, we should always be prepared for it to happen? But how do you live like that?
I think one of the words he used was sudden death. And he said, there is no such thing as sudden death.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because if you ask people, they all are aware they're going to die. All of us are aware of that. So there can't be any such thing as sudden death. And his point is more that we would make different choices were we truly appreciating that death could happen at any moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you feel frozen in place, paralyzed by that thought, then in truth, you haven't accepted that reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh my God, death could happen at any moment. Well, mm-hmm. Yes, that's been that way from the moment you took your first breath.
Right.
But you've just acted like you are entitled to life.
Mm-hmm. Or eternal. And some people truly believe that too, though, which is sad because, I mean, I don't know what happens after we die, but you have to have a certain fear that's disproportionate if you rely on the fact that you could live forever, like as you are.
When you...
Not talking about eternal life, I'm talking about this realm.
If I don't know, of course, what Stephen would say, and he's really worth looking up on the web and chatting with mm-hmm. him, because as I say, this is all new to me. Mm-hmm. It's just somebody struggling with our reaction to the outbreak of the coronavirus. But in one of the interviews, Stephen Jenkinson says, if you take a handful of dirt, he says, what you're looking at is everything that didn't make it. So life is not life-giving. Life is life-taking. And it has to be that way, or there would be no life.
Hmm.
And for me, what it means is, much as the same of the protest that we've been talking about, what if this weren't an aberration? Because I think the struggle many people have is that why don't people get back to what they need to do? Make a living, take care of their families, stop robbing stores. Well, yeah. What opportunity are we given by the realization that this could be every day that we're dealing with this? And we would act differently if we realized that. And if we truly accepted that no one gets out of here alive, we would be making different choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He says, Stephen Jenkinson in the interview says, maybe the real tragedy is not enough people died.
With COVID?
Yeah, because if enough people died, we might finally realign our society to attend to many of the things that you and I have talked about over these last two episodes.
And what's enough, though? What's that? What does that mean?
What's enough?
People who die, like enough people, not enough people died, meaning because we're not reacting as this is a catastrophe, or
we keep waiting for the moment when everything will go back to normal. Mm, you would say you hear this conversation, the new normal, but in reality it's not a new normal, it's more of the same but with face masks. Is what he would say.
Yeah, I don't know, like I go to the stores, I go to the stores, and to me it feels very much like a before after COVID everywhere I go. It even has me, the first few times were a bit emotional. I mean, you go and you see all the, you know, you see the glass windows, you see, you know, the social, it's not even, to me, it's not about, you know, the store or anything like that. It's about, we're living in a different world now.
It's the loss of what was.
Yeah, and we're grieving that. Yes, yes. I mean, it's free. It's a part of our freedom, right?
And that's another thing,
isn't it?
Well, you know,
you're not as free to do what you were used to do.
And that has been
even in your movement. Even forget the spending, but movement-wise, you know.
And again, we can take this to an extreme here, but I think what Stephen would say in this, and again, I'm no expert, is that kind of loss is what a significant percentage of our population lives with every day.
Oh, absolutely.
And they can't go to the store, they can't educate their children, they can't put food on the table.
Yeah,
and in countries around the world, right?
Yes.
Would we be doing differently if more people had died and it finally got our attention? It's a question that I've struggled with since doing the interview. But I don't want to just be paralyzed by it.
Right.
Instead, I want to change myself. It's what I meant when I said that seeing the actions taking place in downtown Chicago, instead of trying to understand it and put people in places, well, those are the white nationalists and those are the anarchists and those are the people who are really aggrieved. You know, instead of doing this, I got to lean in and say, what is this? Help me understand this.
Yeah.
What's and hurting, how have I contributed? How am I contributed by my actions or inactions?
No, it's, I think another thing that does that is traveling, you know, and seeing people in other circumstances. And then, you know, fortunately I've had that. And each time I am changed, you know, going to Cambodia and coming back. In fact, I remind my kids, which they tend to forget, you know, because they were a bit young and whatnot, but my kids, we went to Cambodia, they saw someone die right there on the street, run over, drop off a, you know, there are four or five people on a moped and one falls off and a car drives by. I mean, this happens on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You see that, it's, what kind of reality is that? But what are some of your hopes for our society? We can take America, we can take the world, you know, what do you hope for? What kind of changes would you like to see? If you could see some changes, what would they be?
I guess I would need to think about that in more detail. I have enough work trying to manage the relationships I have in my life that I don't have any grand ambitions. For the world beyond sort of what might be ultimately platitudes about peace and love and kindness towards all humans. I search for personally truth. I desire to have others view me as a kind and a good person. And I struggle with those two things every day.
Yeah. And to be fair, I think if each individual could focus on these things, I mean, what a world would we live in, right? Kindness and being good and being seen, perceived as good, which requires acting a certain way, doing things, not just talking about things. Again, it may sound selfish in a way because it's, you know, what do I need to do? But at the same time, that's where it starts.
Yeah.
You know, we can have these grand ideas of changing the world, but if you don't love yourself first, as we talked about, in the other episode, and then expand that love from within rather than trying to reach out and never fixing what's inside. I mean, I do believe we would live in a much more beautiful world if everyone did that work. And that is why I also believe everyone needs to see a therapist. So, because it's hard work.
It is. There's an old Zen story about a young apprentice monk who goes to the senior monk and asks, what's the meaning of life? And the older, more experienced monk says, wash your bowl. And it's been interpreted multiple ways, but for me, I don't have any grand advice for others how they live their lives. I'm busy enough managing my own existence, and it's about keeping my space clean. I have some very core values, and trying to live up to them is challenge enough. And that's what I focus on. I when I get bigger ideas about how things should be or can be, I wash my bowl.
Thank you. That's a beautiful way to end. Thank you again very, very much for according me, you know, this nearly 3 hours of your time. I know how busy you are. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Be safe.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Phase Transition Podcast. Feel free to leave your comments and questions on any of the platforms you're listening from. I welcome your positive reviews on iTunes, and stay tuned for more episodes coming up soon. This is your host, Juliana, and I will see you next time.